طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts. This week we feature a conversation with Palestinian attorney Diana Boutu and Middle East analyst Phyllis Bennis, recorded at a British roundtable called Palestine Deep Dive. Among other things, they discuss the possible impact of the upcoming U.S. presidential election on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. This conversation was recorded May 1st, 2020.
Welcome to this, the third roundtable live video discussion hosted by Palestine Deep Dive. This time with our guests from the Middle East, from Haifa, and from North America, from Washington, and me in London, England. Today we're going to be asking a number of questions, pertinent questions, looking at events as they unfold, looking in particular to ahead at the U.S. presidential elections in November, and what impact could the elections actually have on policy towards the Middle East, and in particular Palestine. And we want to look at Joe Biden's promise not to move the US embassy back from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv. What does that tell us about the direction of travel? Also, today is May Day, 1st of May, Labor Day. Many Palestinians, as with many workers right across the world, don't have any real labor. They don't have any work to go to. And what we want to know is, what is the situation on the ground? What is it like in the occupied territories at a time of a pandemic? And more specifically, as Benny Gantz and Benjamin Netanyahu push ahead with their July annexation plans, we ask the question, whatever happened to the Israeli Labour Party? I'm Mark Seddon. I've been the UN correspondent for Al Jazeera, and I've worked for the United Nations, for the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and last year for the President of the UN General Assembly, Maria Fernanda Espinosa. And today we want to also hear from all of you. So if you have any questions to our guests, please send them in. We're going to try and get in as many of them as possible, and we want to hear from you. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce our two guests to you today, and thanking them very much for taking the time out to join us. Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis is an American writer and activist. She's a leading advocate of Palestinian rights and speaks widely across the United States and worldwide as part of the global peace movement. Her books include From Stones to Statehood, The Palestinian Uprising, and Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a primer. And she currently directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute of Policy Studies. Diana Boutu, thank you very much for joining us as well. Diana is trained as a lawyer and served as a legal advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team from 2000 to 2005. She was also an advisor to President Mahmoud Abbas. She's taught courses on negotiation skills at Harvard Extension School and held a fellowship at the Stanford Center for Conflict Resolution and Negotiation. And she continues to work as a political analyst. Diana, if I might just begin with you. Going to that, what we were flagging up at the top, the reports this week that Joe Biden, the Democratic Party's nominee for president for this November, when asked about the decision of the Trump administration to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, essentially said he doesn't seem to have any I've got no intention of taking it back. What do you make of all of that? What is the reaction to this in Palestine?
It's not at all surprising. This is one of the things that when the embassy was first moved illegally from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, that many people were commenting, including myself, were saying that this is one of these moves that becomes irreversible, which is why it was so important to oppose it. We knew at the time that there wasn't going to be a Democratic nominee or any president, any U.S. president, that would take the step of reversing this illegal measure. And this is why it was so important to stay firm and continues to stay important to stay firm. In fact, leading up, when there were a number of different candidates that were still running for the primaries, we saw in the pages of the New York Times, they were asked this very question, and there wasn't a single candidate that said that they would be willing to move the embassy back from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv, which just displays the longstanding commitment that the United States has, both parties have, to supporting Israel's settler colonialism and supporting Israeli apartheid. And so this is what was not at all surprising for any of us who've been following the developments on the ground.
But it is sort of surprising for people from the outside, perhaps, who could see that the Europeans were very critical of this. Many other UN member states were critical. The UN itself was critical of all of this. The United States went out on its own. I think from memory, it was followed by a couple of countries from Central America who then backed off, or one of them did. But surely people are asking themselves, Joe Biden as a Democrat could be responsive to pressure from the EU, for instance. What do you think about that?
One would hope so, but look, I think it's important to keep in mind that we are now in a world where we have two countries that are together against the rest of the world. So we have the United States and Israel hand in hand against the international law and against the positions of the rest of the world. That being said, the problem has been so far with the European Union and with other countries around the world is that while they have not embraced this move, as they should not because it is illegal, at the same time, they haven't done anything or they haven't taken any steps to hold Israel accountable. They haven't taken any steps to pressure the United States. They've simply just been waiting it out as though this is some kind of rogue president, and let's just wait for a new president to come along. Well, we may have a new president in November, I don't know, but we're seeing that even those policies of the new president are going to mirror very much the policies of this current president. There may, however, be some differences, I want to be clear. I think that when it comes to resuming funding for UNRWA, we'll probably see some sort of change if Joe Biden becomes the president. We may see some additional funding that goes to the Palestinian Authority. But on the major issues, which is things like Israel's settlement activity, the apartheid state, the continued settler expansion, the home demolitions, and this move of the embassy, it's sad for me to say that the two parties are virtually identical. And we see this with the amount of money that goes to Israel every year from the United States instead of going to the coffer to the people of the United States. It instead goes to support this Israeli settlement.
Diana, and if I'll ask this question of both of you before moving on to another aspect with Phyllis. But if I can stay with you for a moment. I mean, what kind of signal could this send to Netanyahu and Gantz, who are at the moment proposing to move to annex possibly up to 30%, they say, of the West Bank? What if they were to proceed with that? And I mean, do they really think that could force the hand of a President Biden? Do you think a President Biden would go along with that as well? Or is that just a push? Is that too far? Certainly none of the United States allies will support that. But would President Biden just go along with it, as he seems to have been going along with the situation in Jerusalem with the embassy?
It's hard to say, but I think that in the end of the day, it depends in large form of how it is that the Israelis do the annexation. I suspect that they're going to do an annexation along the same way that they did the annexation of Jerusalem, which is to say that they extend the application of Israeli law, and then the people there just end up being what they call residents, who are never really permanent residents, but people whose residency can be effectively revoked and be made stateless. This is what I expect that the Israelis are going to do. And I suspect that the U.S. response is going to be as weak as it has been when it came to the issue of Jerusalem, and as weak as it has been over the course of the past 50 years, when we've seen that, in effect, Israel has already annexed the large parts of the West Bank. The real issue here is what it is that the United States is willing to do. And so far, it's been shown, Netanyahu's gotten the message that it doesn't matter what he does, he can continue ahead. And now he also has along his side Benny Gantz, who has also very much embraced this concept of annexation. Has also, in fact, labeled it his own. I want to say something very quickly, though, about this this unity government before turning it over to Phyllis, which is to say that this unity government that was signed very recently, or that was may be formed in the coming days, but the agreement was signed very recently between Gantz and Netanyahu. It's supposed to be an emergency government that's only supposed to focus on dealing with issues of the coronavirus. And yet there's and all of the legislation that's supposed to be pushed during this period is only supposed to deal with coronavirus, with the exception of one piece of legislation, and that is annexation. And in this agreement, they've made it clear that annexation can proceed as quickly as July 1st, provided that there is U.S. support for it. And we've already seen that the Trump administration has given its approval for it. So I think if there is a President Biden that will come into the office, he will have already seen that annexation will have already taken place. And I don't think that he's going to take the steps of reversing something that has already been done.
Phyllis, if I may come to you, thank you, Diana, but come to you, I mean, again, looking from the outside, the Trump administration has moved the goalposts so far in many ways and has advanced the and worked so closely with the Netanyahu agenda. A real gap appeared to be opening up, at least until Joe Biden's emergence as the Democratic Party nominee, a real gap between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and also something of a development within the American Jewish community as well, a feeling amongst very many of them that essentially this really was unacceptable, that the way this was heading was something they could not support. And, you know, it would appear that, you know, there were many voices within the Democratic Party who were speaking out in a way that we hadn't heard for a long time, including that, of course, of Senator Bernie Sanders. So if President Trump is returned in November, where does this leave this growing body of opinion in the United States that really this special relationship is really going deeply sour?
Well, you know, I think that we have to acknowledge that there is an enormous gap that has emerged between the leadership of certainly the Democratic Party and the Democratic Party's base, its voters. There's been a huge shift in the political discourse, the public discourse, and the media discourse on the question of U.S. relations with Israel, the question of Palestine. It's been largely a combination of factors, partly the fact that the Israeli actions, the military assaults on Gaza, the expansion of settlements, all of it has been not only far worse in recent years, but far more visible to more people. There's cell phones everywhere, there's cameras everywhere, there's video everywhere in social media. So all of the Israeli efforts to keep the media out simply doesn't work anymore. So people know about it, they're more outraged, and that discourse shift has been a very profound one if we look at 10 years ago, 5 years ago, even 2 years ago. But if we look at the policy, that's where the shift is just barely beginning to take off. And that's the challenge for people in the United States who are committed to Palestinian rights. It's not enough to simply say Palestinians have the same human rights as everyone else. That's true and insufficient because Palestinians continue to be denied access to those rights. So I think what we're looking at now with this divide between Democratic members of Congress, Democratic leadership, and the Democratic voters is that the question of U.S. support for Israel has indeed become a sectarian, partisan issue. If you look at the polls, it's dramatic that it's somewhere in this around 70% of Republicans praise the U.S. special relationship with Israel. On the Democratic side, I'm forgetting the numbers, but I think it's way down in the 30s or perhaps even below. It's a huge gap. that is not reflected in the political positions taken by the members of Congress, and certainly not with this White House. So, you know, this has been going on for a while. There was a poll back in 2010 that indicated 63% of Democrats, right at the moment when the friction between Obama, President Obama, and Netanyahu was very, very stark. And there was a lot of challenge to it in the U.S. press. There was a lot of claiming, falsely, of course, that Obama is throwing Israel under the bus. You know, there was no bus. Nobody was being thrown anywhere. U.S. military aid to Israel was not going anywhere except up. It was increasing, not decreasing. But the press coverage was very much focused on the tension between the two, mostly because Netanyahu treated President Obama with such extraordinary racism. In that context, still, 63% of Democrats chose an option of all settlements should be disbanded and the land returned to its original owners. A very dramatic reading, certainly in keeping with international law, but a very dramatic way of describing what should happen. So it's clear that popular opinion is very different. Mm. Now, what that means, again, comes back to what we can do as a movement, the kind of extremist actions that the Trump administration has taken, not the kind of careful, cautious support for Israel that has characterized earlier administrations, but the overt character of it, moving the embassy, recognizing the permanent, supposedly, occupation of the Golan Heights, cutting the support for UNRWA, accepting the annexation of Jerusalem, all of these things, military aid remaining the same. We have an extremist foreign policy in power in the White House and the State Department right now between Trump and Pompeo. So this isn't different in that sense. This has been an extremist administration, both in domestic and foreign policy. So in that context, I think that we have to look again to the movements in the United States that are fighting for Palestinian rights. This is a moment when...
Can I interrupt you on that, Phyllis, just to take that further on? Because let us just say, for the sake of argument, that what may be motivating Joe Biden is what he's being told by his pollsters and what he needs to do in order to get elected. Let's just say that might be happening. Let's just say also that he is successfully elected and becomes the next president. Right. Do you think, with the pressure that could come, what you've just been describing in terms of how the polls are shifted, how opinion is shifting, how the Democratic Party has shifted and its composition in the Senate and the Congress, do you think that real pressure could then be brought to bear on a President Biden to change the policy?
Absolutely. There's no guarantees here. This is, as you've both said, this is a long-standing part of U.S. history. The so-called special relationship with Israel has been a bipartisan reality for 70 years. So that's the starting point. But the notion that we can influence a White House with Biden leading it is far greater than the chance of influencing a White House under Donald Trump. There's no guarantees, but right now, for example, the Biden campaign knows they need Bernie Sanders supporters to win this election. They can't win it by just being, you know, the nice guy who's going to bring the country together. There's simply not the votes for that. There's not enough excitement in his campaign. Young people are looking at his campaign and saying, what's in it for us? There's no reflection of the things that inspired people in the Bernie Sanders campaigns, whether it was Medicare for all, whether it was a new kind of foreign policy, cutting the military budget, and yes, changing the relationship between the U.S. and Israel. It doesn't mean that Biden is going to feel obligated to accept all of those positions, but it does mean that people who worked on Sanders' campaigns are now collaborating with some of the people working on the Biden campaign. There is the possibility of bringing a new kind of pressure on this campaign that we haven't had in the past. So again, it comes back to how the movements engage with power. This isn't any longer only about the educational work, the boycott work, as important as all of that is, this is now a moment when we can actually engage with people in power, engage with the people running these campaigns to say, look, you have to recognize how the discourse has changed, that it not only is no longer political suicide to criticize Israel, it's rapidly approaching a point. We're not there yet, but we're rapidly approaching a point when it will be political suicide not to criticize Israel. Yeah, good. That's point. A very different moment.
Thank you very much. And Diana, coming back to you, I mean, we also got to look, by the way, this isn't all about, we just don't want to spend all our time talking about what happens in US presidential elections, important that they are, but I'm just going to stay with it just a bit longer, if that's all right, and to talk about the potential Trump second administration, the second victory for Trump, what that could mean. Given that so much of what is happening right now is happening underneath this horrible cloak of a pandemic, so the eyes and ears are averted elsewhere in many ways. Let's say this annexation plan goes ahead. Let's say Trump is re-elected. Where realistically now does this lead to the two-state solution, the Oslo Accords, all the rest of it? I suspect I know what you're going to say in many ways, but how is it possible that the international community, the serious members of the international community who really know what's going on, can continue to hang on to all of this? What happens next to the idea of this, of the sticking to the idea of this two-state solution?
So it's interesting that you asked that question. I've been looking back at the assistance that the international community has been providing to the Palestinian Authority. And in looking back at that assistance that they've been providing to the Palestinian Authority, one diplomat commented to me once that that they're in a space where they're trying to decide whether they are actually building a Palestinian state or whether they are actually funding the occupation. And I think that after all of these years where we've had Oslo that began in 1993, we're now in the year 2020, it was 27 years later, we're not even one step closer to having an independent state, that it's become very clear that their role is to fund the occupation. And in that role of funding the occupation, which is what they've done, they haven't put the brakes on any of Israel's activities. So while they talk about wanting to have a two-state solution, they've done absolutely nothing to implement it. They've done everything to just make sure that there's funding in place for the Palestinian Authority, but nothing really to deal with the issue of the two-state solution. So where that leaves us now is the same place that it left us a few months ago, which is that I just don't see that there's going to be any change, with one exception. I'm cognizant that the money that's going to come to the Palestinian Authority in the coming months, if not years, is going to be much less than it was before because of this pandemic, with governments now focused much more on supporting people within their own borders rather than supporting Palestinians, supporting refugees, supporting the global community. And so that being said, I do think that we're going to start seeing a shift where people are demanding, instead of this idea of statehood, that instead they start demanding one state. Now, the Europeans are not there yet, and they won't be there for a long period of time.
What about the General Assembly? Sorry to interrupt you there, Diana. What about the General Assembly? Do we start getting some more initiatives coming through there from the non-aligned movement, from other member states? Do we start seeing some real pressure for this? But once you kick away the figment of this idea of a two-state solution, if parts of the West Bank are going to be occupied, annexed, I mean, what is to stop member states to say, let's stop pretending, let's start being constructive and move on to the next chapter?
I certainly hope that it will be the next shape. And this is why I think it's important for us to continue to press, as Phyllis was mentioning, not just for BDS, but to also be holding Israel accountable. It's these accountability measures that I think are the most important at this point in time. Left to their own devices, we're just going to continue to see that it'll be the same setup as before, with a whole number of states supporting Palestine, Micronesia, and Vanuatu, supporting the United States. But now is the time where we need to start seeing that shift in international activity. We as Palestinians have done our share, pushed it. We've been resisting. We've been making sure that we do not accept these proposals, that we don't accept annexation. And it's now time for the international community to do their part.
I've got a couple of questions coming in. The first question is from Fahed Abu Akel, and he says, what do both speakers have to say about the new Jewish state law? What do you have to, Phyllis, what do you have to say about that?
Yes, thanks for that, Fahed. You know, it's funny. I was just thinking about something in response to something Diana said, that the situation that, as a result of these extremist positions of the Trump administration, which of course are enabling the kind of extremism that we're seeing from Netanyahu and the Israeli government, including the nation state law, the so-called nation state law, one of the effects of them all is to make it impossible to deny that the Israeli system is a system of apartheid. That was something that was always denied vehemently in the US and in the Israeli government. A few, in the last few years, a few members of the government would take the rather brave step in their context of saying that if we don't make some changes, our system is going to start looking like an apartheid system, you know, very cautious. The reality is it is and has been an apartheid system for many, many years now, for decades, for generations, in fact. And what we're looking at now is that it's become almost impossible to deny that. So the case of the nation state law, which essentially says it passed as the what would be the equivalent in the United States would be a constitutional amendment. It's a change to the basic law, not just a regular old law that can be changed by another Knesset, but a change to the basic law that says, among other things, that only Jews have the right of self-determination in the state of Israel, that Arabic is no longer an official language of the state of Israel. It's an explicit statement that the state of Israel is only for Jews, and the 20 or 21% of Israeli citizens, we're not even talking here about Palestinians who live under military occupation in East Jerusalem or the West Bank or the Gaza Strip, but we're talking about Palestinian citizens, that they do not have the rights of Jewish citizens. And that is, by definition, a violation of the international covenant against the crime of apartheid. So I think that's really something that we have to grab. The question of what happens in the General Assembly, there have been moments, Mark, you've seen it, and Diana, you've been around the UN for all those debates as well, and I have been as well, too, when Father Miguel Descoto, for instance, was the president of the General Assembly at the beginning of the of Operation Cast Lead, the first of the three major Israeli assaults on Gaza in recent years. And there was leadership in the General Assembly from the Non-Aligned and from others to take a much stronger position than the Security Council was prepared to do, for instance, because of fear of a U.S. veto. And they would rather simply not take any position than allow the U.S. to veto it. But the problem is the General Assembly has not yet been mobilized in a way that brings in the stronger countries. The Europeans generally stand aside and abstain on the key issues. And we don't yet have the power from governments that are prepared to challenge the U.S. directly on behalf of the Palestinians. And the position of Palestinian diplomacy is still that of the international position of calling for a two-state solution. So it's important to hear from Diana and the position of Palestinians. We also have to recognize, Mark, that you and I don't get to make this call. We don't get to say it should be one state or two states or red state or blue state. This is something that has to be determined by Palestinians, how they define their liberation and what that strategy is.
A perfect segue to Diana and to that question from Fahed.
The Jewish nation state law is a law that I actually call the Jewish supremacy law. And the reason I call it that is because the whole focus of it, it's a law that comes 70 years after the Nakba, 70 years after, after years and years, 70 years after laws, discriminatory laws and Supreme Court rulings that entrench those discriminatory laws. And yet they felt it important to actually pass, as Phyllis said, the equivalent of a constitutional amendment to entrench and to enshrine all of this racism into a law. You know, and the split that occurred inside Israel over the nation, the Jewish nation state law was not one about its content. It was a split over whether they should actually have a law or not, with some people saying, look, we're already getting what we want. If you look at the Supreme Court is already ruling in our favor. It's already saying that in weighing the issue of whether it's a Jewish state or a democracy, that Jewish state should take supremacy. And so the debate was, why put this in front of the world? Why make this so obvious, as Phyllis said, to the world that we're an apartheid state? And the answer is that now it's not just a question of them of it being an apartheid state, but they're unabashed about it. This is actually for them a real victory. They want to say to the world, yes, we are an apartheid state, and what's the problem with it? Mm-hmm. So this is why I think it's very important for people to be pushing back.
They may be saying that, but there does seem to be a major effort underway to attack anybody who's vaguely critical of all of this, attempt to box everybody in to stop people speaking out. We've just actually had another. I'm just going to ask one other question from our audience before we move on to another issue I just wanted to raise with you. But Delinda Hanley has got in touch. She asked this question. I'll come to you again first, Diane, if I may. She says, in the year 2000, Arab and Muslim American voters asked presidential candidates Bush and Gore to end the use of secret evidence to deport immigrants and also ethnic profile by airline companies. Bush promised to do so. Can you suggest one issue, and this is for both of you, I'll start with Diana, can you suggest one issue each, domestic or international, that this community, as well as other human rights supporters, can get behind?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's many. The first that comes to mind is...
There has to be one, Diana.
Yeah, all right, well... look, there's. Oh, I'll come up with two: one domestic and one national. I think it's deplorable that the United States continues to provide aid to Israel, and I think that that's something that really has to be pushed back against, particularly now given the state of the economy in the United States and the state of the economy around the world. It makes no sense for Israel to be getting this money. Second, and this might surprise some people, is I think it's absolutely deplorable that Israel continues to be allowed to demolish Palestinian homes, particularly in this time when we're all being asked to self-isolate, stay at home and stay safe, that Israel is continuing its policy of home demolitions. And it's continuing to do so without even so much as a peep coming out from the European Union and from the United States and others. And these are two that just immediately come to mind. I'm sure Phyllis has some better ones than I do.
Phyllis?
I don't know. Those are hard ones to beat. I would say that my both domestic and international choice would be the question of the $3.8 billion a year that the U.S. sends directly to the Israeli military. Israel is depending on whether you believe the IMF or the World Bank, Israel is either the 23rd or the 27th wealthiest country in the world. There's no rational, moral reason for us to be giving any money to their country, let alone their military. So that's the first part. The question of what that enables when it covers about 20% of the Israeli military budget, it means that Israel can go ahead without worrying about consequences. If we were going to choose one other, I would say the military aid question and the issue of the Israeli military system for arresting and detaining juveniles. This is the only country in the world that has a military juvenile detention system, and there is a U.S. law that is pending, introduced by Congresswoman Betty McCollum from Minnesota, to say, and it's the first time there's been a U.S. law proposed in the Congress to prevent any U.S. aid money. It's a very mild law. It doesn't actually call for cutting the military aid at all. It just makes sure that none of that money is used for this horrific system in which the Israeli military is authorized to arrest and try children as young as 12, arresting them at 2 o'clock in the morning, deliberately because it's known to be more terrifying that way. It's a horrific situation. So I would say ending the U.S. collaboration with the military detention system for juveniles and cutting U.S. military aid to Israel.
Well, thank you both for that. Diana, moving on, today is the 1st of May, Labor Day. I've been looking around in Britain today. The usual marches and banners just aren't there. A lot of people, of course, can't go anywhere because they're locked down, as people are all over the world, and including in Israel-Palestine. So my question really to you, because you're there, is can you give us some idea of what the situation is for Palestinian workers? What has happened to the world of work? How are people coping without work?
These are really amazing questions. So I first want to talk about Palestinians who are working inside the Green Line, inside Israel, and their situation. Then I can talk about the bigger population. So there's about 80,000 Palestinians who work inside Israel. And for decades, these individuals have been subjected to some of the worst forms of security searches, of detentions, of checks, and so on. And for years, there have been calls to have these workers be able to live inside the places in which they work or nearby the places in which they work and not have to be subjected to this constant stream of checkpoints and security measures and so on. And yet Israel has instituted a policy of collective punishment, which is to say that every Palestinian has to fall within the security apparatus. Suddenly, overnight, when this pandemic hit, these same workers who were once subjected to endless searches suddenly became classified as essential workers. And being classified as essential workers, because many of them are, many of them work in hospitals, in construction, and other areas as well, sanitation, and so on. Suddenly, the restrictions were now relaxed. There was no longer a need to go through checkpoints. There was no longer a need to go through these security searches. And provided that their employers were to provide them with adequate housing during this period. And the employers promised to do so. What we ended up seeing was very quickly that the conditions in which these people were, Palestinians were being forced to live were conditions that were subhuman, that were places without proper sanitation, without proper running water, you name it. And so now we're seeing that many of these Palestinian workers are now going back to the West Bank, many of them actually carrying the coronavirus. Now, The fact that they're going back is because they haven't been provided with adequate housing. They haven't been provided with any adequate measures to be able to stay in place. But their salaries are also not being guaranteed. They have never, Israel has always refused to hand over any of the money that it deducts from Palestinian workers for Social Security. Even though they deduct it, they've never handed it over to the Palestinian Authority. So these are people who are among the most vulnerable in society, who have been tossed around, one hand labeled as security threats, the next second labeled as essential workers, and been treated as though they are simply dispensable, with none of their rights ever being afforded or protected. On the larger scale, on the larger both West Bank and Gaza scale, we're talking about very high numbers of unemployment. In the Gaza Strip alone, there's 53% unemployment. These are huge numbers. And in the West Bank, also very high numbers of unemployment. Now with the impact of the coronavirus, where a lot of governments would be coming forward and trying to provide stimulus packages and trying to provide compensation to people who are out of work, we simply don't see that because the Palestinian Authority is a government that is donor dependent and donor driven. So we are not going to see that people are going to be able to get off of their feet or get off their feet and be able to support one another in the aftermath of this pandemic. So I suspect that we're going to see even more poverty, even more food insecurity, and even higher rates of unemployment.
Well, that sounds pretty grim. Certainly no cause for celebration on the 1st of May. And actually, it brings me on to another question that's just literally coming from Jim Haber. I'll put this to you, Phyllis, if I may. Have you been following or involved in the development of the One Democratic State campaign that I think was unveiled yesterday? Seems very far from where we are, but very necessary to develop such long-term vision. Do you know much about this initiative?
I don't know about what happened yesterday. There's been a long period in the U.S. I can remember back in the 1970s debates over one state, two states. And I think what I've come to realize is that this really is an issue for Palestinians to determine in the context of their strategy for liberation. For those of us who support Palestinian rights, we can have our opinions. I won't surprise you to know I have opinions about this issue. But it's not really my call. You know, I'm a Jewish girl from California.
Let's neatly pass that to Diana in that case.
But wait, can I just say one other thing? I think it doesn't mean that we don't have obligations here. Yes. It just means that we don't have the right to determine should the focus be on one state or two states. For me, the issue is rights, equality, human rights. And when we fight for those rights, it's up to Palestinians to determine whether it's in one state where everybody has the same rights or two states where everyone has the same rights within both states and between both states, which is not often talked about. So it's a question of rights and not states.
Diana.
I'm actually part of the One Democratic State campaign. So thanks for the question. Yes, it's been a platform that we've been working on for quite some time. It's a group of Israelis, of Palestinians, primarily based here, with a lot of signatories from abroad, from around the world. But the essential movement was the essential idea was to try to get a platform that is launched from Palestine. The campaign is an important one. It focuses, unlike others campaigns, which just focus on one state and not really how to get there. This focuses on decolonization and has as one of its very essential elements the issue of the right of return. So, in the context of while the world is talking about annexation, one state, two state, etc., here we have a platform. That is actually a vision that's being put forward by Palestinians, by people who are on the ground, that is calling for something that is completely different, that focuses on the root cause being Zionism and addressing Zionism from the standpoint of the people who've been most affected by it, rather than accommodating it.
Thank you, Diana. I'm going back to the theme of labor, if I may. And I wanted to direct this question to you, Phyllis. I mean, again, for people looking from the outside who remember the Israeli Labour Party of old and remember that it was part of the Socialist International, took a very different approach to what it seems to be taking today. My question is, you know, what on earth has happened to the Israeli? This is Labour Day, but what has happened to the Israeli Labour Party? And also, I mean, I discovered today one other question just to ask you. They left the Israeli Labour Party is no longer part of the Socialist International, but it still has observer status with the Party of European Socialists. And I just wondered if you had any ideas about that and what should happen.
Well, I actually don't think it's such an enormous change from the history of the Labour Party. Certainly the early Labour Party was part of the Socialist International. The notion of what some Zionist forces were trying to build in Palestine was a socialist Israel, a socialist Jewish state. And yet they were prepared to build socialist institutions, the kibbutzim being the most obvious, on land that was expropriated from the indigenous population without ever really talking about that. That was the kind of Zionism that I grew up in my Sunday school, when I was a Sunday school teacher, all of that. We taught about Israel as a socialist paradise, and the kibbutz movement was the core of it. That was never separate from the question of control of the land and seizing the land from the indigenous population that was already there. I think that the notion of annexation might have been accepted by the early Zionist leadership if they knew that they were going to have U.S. support for it in an explicit way. We should remember that settlement of the West Bank and Gaza began under the Labour Party. It wasn't the right wing. So the Israeli Labour Party was socialist within a certain context, but was also thoroughly colonialist in its understanding of its rights to the land. So it isn't, I think, such an enormous shift right now. There is a huge shift that's been underway within the broad Israeli left, of which the Labour Party hasn't really been the leader of the left for a very long time. The left has taken a huge hit, and it's smaller than ever. It's more beleaguered than ever. and it's in serious trouble, I would say, in Israel. But the Labour Party itself, I think, really was, from the beginning, a Zionist party that was committed to maintaining control of what they would consider the land of Israel for Jews and not to be shared with the Palestinians. There were individuals who may have believed that, but that was never the real operative position of the Labour Party.
Looking at the situation right now, a kind of a weird kind of Israeli political triangulation underway. I mean, given all of that history that you've outlined, which would suggest really there's not a fantastical amount of change there. But given that right now the Israeli Labour Party doesn't really pretend to be particularly socialistic at all and seems to have more or less the same policy as Likud, will it simply disappear?
It certainly could. It doesn't any longer play a qualitatively different role in Israeli society, economically, socially, politically, than the leadership of the Likud. These are parties that are driven as much by sort of personalities and who's going to be in charge at any given moment as they are by ideological differences. The ideological have shrunk. The differences have shrunk. So I think that it's certainly possible it would disappear. I'm not sure that that would have an enormous impact on the politics of Israel. If we look at what the politics have been for the last 10 years or so, Netanyahu, as prime minister during that period, in a certain way really represents the left wing of his parliament, of his cabinet, not because he has moved to the left, but because he has recruited further and further to the right. So the party, the cabinet, the government is now made up of the right, the far right, the extreme right, and really the fascist right within Israeli politics. The left or the centrists are really not much of a force anymore. Benny Gantz, who was the hoped for alternative to Netanyahu by some, was the military commander in 2014 who oversaw the destruction of Gaza and the killing of 2,200 people in the Gaza Strip. And his campaign video was a helicopter tour over the devastation of Gaza, bragging about how much death and destruction he brought about. So that's what was considered the left wing alternative to Netanyahu.
Well, I mean, so I think it's something we should really come back to at a future Palestine deep dive. I think this would be a real education for a lot of people out there.
Sure.
I'm going to come to another question. This is coming from Kieran Baker in Washington. This for you, Diana. Is there any hope that the joint list and ODA can make a real impact? And as a follow-up, how would you sum up or characterize the Palestinian political leadership?
The joint list, I'm going to step back for a second. Most people, when you think of an opposition, you think of an opposition movement that is, you kind of want your people when you vote to make it into government, and you want them to be able to be ministers, and you want them to be like, if they're not in the government, then kind of opposing what the government is doing, but on the sidelines, like on the front lines. When it comes to the joint list, it's a little bit different. The joint list will never join the government because this is a government of occupation. And they will never become part of a government that is taking the decision to drop bombs on Gaza or taking the decision to demolish Palestinian homes. That's just not going to happen. So their role always has been as opposition, but not as opposition in the classic sense of the word that we have inside the Israeli Knesset, but as an opposition to all of the action and all of the actions that are coming out of the Knesset that are against Palestinians. And so their role is kind of threefold that I think of it. It's to try to be an opposition to prevent the deterioration, to hold on to Palestinian rights for Palestinian citizens of Israel, to be able to try to make sure that Palestinians stay on the ground, and as much as possible to serve as an opposition to the occupation, because every other party is actually in favor of the occupation, with the exception of Meretz, which has two seats. So their role is really not just to be in opposition, but it's to be in even further opposition to try to present a very different vision. in this way, look, they've been doing this for decades now, and we're seeing that as the numbers of the individuals who are in the joint list rise, that there's even more racist legislation that is coming that is attempting to be passed. So their work, they really do have their work cut out for them, and they continue to try to push back against that, against those racist laws. As for the West Bank or the other Palestinian political leadership, it's non-existent. It's been a political leadership that is stagnant, that is focused only on Oslo, that doesn't have a vision beyond Oslo. But I think it's important to keep in mind, it's not just a leadership that is solely focused on Oslo. It's also a leadership that is focused on its own survival. And so it has taken measures to do everything to quash any form of opposition, any form of resistance. They've gone after the Palestinian Authority, has gone after the media, they've gone after judges, they've gone after NGOs. So it's not just a stagnant Palestinian Authority, but one that is being active in its pursuit of making sure that they are the only address that is in place in the West Bank.
Well, staying on that subject and going to Phyllis. I mean, what's your judgment? I mean, you know, obviously you're not there, but you're a long-time observer of all of this. What is your judgment in terms of the Palestinian Authority? And can this edifice actually still stand post July annexation, or does it just crumble away?
Well, I think that we have to look back to something that Diana said very crucially early on in our discussion today, which is about the origins of Oslo and the origins of the Palestinian Authority within Oslo. It was a product of the Oslo Accords. And the other parts of the Oslo Accords that were supposed to involve negotiations for the end of occupation never happened. What has survived from Oslo is the PA. Now, it can survive because it's funded from outside. It doesn't depend on local support, local taxation. It depends on European and U.S. funding. Increasingly, the U.S.
Israeli funding as well, aren't they?
The Europeans are still providing the bulk of the funding to the PA. Mm-hmm. So the structure can survive, presumably, for a long time. Whether it will have much relevance in a period where there is little land left to even discuss the possibility of an independent state, let alone a viable independent state, is a different question. So as that happens, I think that we will see the PA having a somewhat different relationship to the people who live under its jurisdiction in the West Bank. The important thing here, though, is the PA never had real authority, despite its name. It has what we might call kind of municipal authority. It never had the ability to function as a real government. With the recognition of Palestine as a state by the United Nations and by certain countries, there are certain diplomatic things that have been made possible, most notably the work with the International Criminal Court, that has the one possibility still, it's a very long shot, but the possibility of holding Israel accountable for some of its war crimes over the years. But in terms of actual control of borders, control of its water, control of the seas off its coast, the Palestinian Authority doesn't have control of any of that. And a Palestinian state, as envisioned in the U.S. proposals, in Oslo, also it was never anticipated that that, quote, state would have actual control, would have actual authority, would have a military if it chose, or not a military if it chose not to, would have control of its borders, would have control of its own economy, would control the seas off its coast. None of that was supposed to be in a so-called Palestinian state. So on that level, it has not changed in the 27 years since the Oslo Accord was first signed.
You have been listening to Diana Boutu in conversation with Phyllis Bennis on the British Roundtable Palestine Deep Dive. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer
at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم